It's sure a pleasure to be here. If you look at the title, it says I'm supposed to be talking about type 1 and type 2 BVD, but I didn't have a real choice on what the title was. That's just what was sent to me. I'm going to be talking about BVD in general. And hopefully the point is we're at a point in time where herds are going to be contemplating expansion in the next few years and increasing numbers, especially as we work our way out of this drought situation. And there are some concerns that we need to address relative to this particular disease. Now, I'm trying to get a hold of this. What do we know about BVD? Basically, the BVD virus has been around since the 1940s. It's in the genus Pestivirus. Similar diseases are in sheep, where we have border disease, and it's also associated with hog cholera. It should be noted that hog cholera has been eradicated from the United States, so that ought to give you some food for thought. But this family has many, many strains within the family, and it's an RNA virus. Okay, there are two types of or phenotypes of virus that are characterized on the basis of lab characteristics. Cytopathic, and I'm trying to get my arrow to work, cytopathic and non-cytopathic strains. Is it showing up? Okay. Literally, what that means is cytopathic is the ability to kill cells on tissue culture, as evident down here in this picture where it's killing the cells here. This particular strain here on tissue culture does not destroy the cells. Okay, the standard virus, really, and I can't hardly read this here because of my glasses, and I have to look at the screen here, is the non-cytopathic strain. That accounts for probably over 90% of infections. Yeah, I'm trying to see. It's got to be moved over just a bit. Okay, yeah, there we go. Thank you. Yeah, the two genotypes that people are real concerned right now are type 1 and type 2. There's considerable diversity between these two genotypes, and there's a lot of shared genetic material between the two types here, about 60% genetic sharing. There's wide variation in the disease-producing ability with both type 1 and type 2. And even within types, there's considerable variation in terms of actual disease-producing ability. So there's just a lot of variation that if you're just testing and found one particular type, you may have within that type one that's very, very virulent, or you may have one that is not so disease-producing. Okay, that's okay. Now, when we look at the BVD effects within a herd, I think we need to think about this triangle. Many or most of the infections are going to be transient and be completely inapparent. And even if they do affect production, we're going to see effects that we may not be able to measure, or that we won't appreciate because they may be pretty subtle. Particularly in endemic herds, these losses or production losses in this area may be quite transparent. But when we get to the clinical cases, those are the ones that are going to show up, and you're going to have some obvious production losses associated in this area here. And usually, this is when we have initial exposure with BVD. Now, most cases are what we call an acute form of BVD, and really what happens, we tend to get exposure of an animal to the virus, we have a short incubation period, and we get a viremia. We might get an immune response, or we should get an immune response where we get seroconversion, and we'll get low shedding of the virus for a short period of time. I got the word PI down here, a persistent infected animal, and we'll tell you about that farther in the talk here. But basically compared to what we get with a transient infection, we get a tremendous amount of virus that's going to be shed by a PI animal. Some of the clinical manifestations that you're going to see, and the reason I'm covering this here, is because some people says, well, you know, I've never had any of this in my herd. I haven't looked at it. I haven't noticed any production loss or anything. Well, have you ever had a calf born that couldn't maintain its balance? One of the common defects that's associated with that is a central nervous system problem associated with BVD. That right down here in the brain, the cerebellum is small and it doesn't have the ability to maintain its balance. Sometimes those animals don't live very long, okay? You ever had a hairless calf on your operation? There are others. This particular calf here, you might look like it's normal, but it only weighs about 35 pounds. Full-term calf that is dysmeturia, it's not a preemie. Look in the mouth. Look at its teeth. It's got a full set of teeth. And that, you know, some other things that you'll see is cleft palate. I've seen scoliosis. You know, and sometimes you'll see a lot of things. But, you know, a lot of these things like this, people get a calf like that, knock it in the head, never even keep track of it. Not even keep information on that. What can the virus do? The virus has two main forms. It can, you know, it'll cause an acute infection, transient infection, but it has the ability to affect that fetus in utero. And this particular graph here kind of tells what happens if you have an infection to the fetus during gestation. And we're going to, off to the left here, this is at breeding, goes clear across to the end. You can have infertility problems, which would be manifested with some repeat breeding. Later on, as that embryo develops, if we have infection with that virus, we can develop a persistent infected animal. And that can occur up till about 100, day 125, and then there's a gray area in there, and we know that some animals can become persistently infected. The reason for this gray area is there is a point in time during that gestation where that calf can mount its own immune response to the virus. Generally, we talk about 150 days and beyond of gestation for them to be able to do that. Okay, so if they're exposed out in this area here, they could mount a response and you may not have a persistent infected animal. Okay. But please note, there's a range clear throughout here where we could get an abortion, we could actually have a calf that's born that's weak, or we could have stillbirths. Okay. But the congenital defects are generally associated right down here in the same area as is the persistent infected. But don't forget, once calf is born, if you have BVD going through the herd, you can have losses associated with BVD, even though you may not have had fetal infection. Okay? And that's because BVD is so immune suppressing that other diseases, because of immunosuppression, can move up the ladder and cause losses of animals. Okay? Now, how do we get a PI? For years, we've known that if we had a PI mother or a PI dam, that she herself was born persistently infected, we knew that 100% of her calves would be PIs. And we looked at that to be the major way that we were really going to get the PI calf in the herd. Whittem and Associates, with a very good study where they surveyed herds that were randomly selected through veterinary clinics throughout the West here, they come up with information that really showed that PI calf, over 93% of the calves that were PI found in herds actually came from mothers that were not PI themselves, but just had exposure or an overwhelming exposure to the virus. Okay, that's not to say that the PI animal in the herd isn't the source or the initial source of that virus. What are some of the outcomes of a persistent infected calf? Because we want to focus on that one, because that's the key to some management strategies that you need to put in place or have in mind if you're going to add replacements to your herd, or if you have had the problem. These PI animals are destined for a short lifespan. About 50% of them will die within the first year of life. And if you talk to some virologists, they'll say they haven't found a PI animal beyond about 3 years of age. Well, that is true. There's very few of them that's going to survive beyond about 3 to 4 years of age, but there are going to be a few. But the outcomes here, you can have a calf born that'll die at or near birth. It could have a calf die from mucosal disease, it would be born normally, and then get exposed later to some more virus and die. It could die from other diseases because of the immune compromising problems. It could survive till maturity, but be less than healthy. And it could survive to maturity and could also reproduce. Okay. Now, this is mucosal disease, which early on, long before we identified persistent infected animals, mucosal disease was one of the major forms of the disease. And what we got is we got these lesions throughout the GI tract and the mouth and everything. And what it amounted to is we had a persistent infected animal, which was caused by non-cytopathic BVD. And then we get exposure to a cytopathic strain of BVD. And because it could not mount an immune response against the BVD virus, it got overwhelmed and would die, and it would die fairly rapidly. A common, and I'm going to call it a myth out there, that basically if you use just modified live virus BVD vaccines, if they have cytopathic strain in them, that you're going to be able to eliminate these animals from your herd fairly rapidly. When they tried to do some studies to see if they could eliminate these animals with modified live, they haven't been able to do it. So, you know, there's anecdotal evidence that use of modified live with cytopathic strains that you might eliminate a few of these, but the results have been far less than 100%. Thinking right now is basically the reason some animals die from mucosal disease is literally we have the ability of a non-cytopathic strain of the virus to mutate and become cytopathic. So this is another thing about the virus here. It has the ability to change. Okay. Now, I can recall a presentation about, it's almost 18 years ago when a well-respected individual got up and said, you know, if I find these animals in the herd, I know they're PIs. In other words, he was saying he could visually pick up these animals that were PI. Well, what does a PI animal look like? Well, we would like to think they're all like that compared to their peers. But literally, every animal on this slide is a PI animal. You look over here, these fairly normal looking, except if you look close, you've got some swollen joints there. Well, here's the cow that survived. This is an 8-year-old cow with a PI calf on her side. She's a PI herself. That calf weighed about 30 pounds. Here's another one that's up 3 years. And here's some that looks pretty normal, but they're all PI animals. Point is we cannot look at a group of animals and tell whether one animal is a PI and another one. Okay. What's the prevalence of PIs within the herd? And again, this is a Whittam study here where they randomly selected these herds here. In herds that were randomly selected, they found a very low herd prevalence. Herd prevalence. In other words, less than 4% of the herds that were randomly selected had one PI in it. But if they had herds that had a previous history or had clinical signs to BVD, or they had had a diagnosis of BVD in the history, almost 20% of those herds, they found PIs. Okay. Now, what about the bull? The bull is an introduction, I mean, serves as a source of introduction in the herd. But what are the things we know about the bull? We know that it is possible for a bull to be a PI. We know the testes here are an immunologically protected site. So even if it comes from a transient infection and the bull is not PI, we can have shedding of the virus for a prolonged period of time via the semen, even though systemically the animal would be negative. Work down at Auburn shows that virus may be shed for, 60 to 70 days. If it's a persistently infected bull, the amount of virus that's going to be shed through the semen is going to be tremendous. We do know that if we expose susceptible females to infected semen, we're going to get transmission and infection. Are we going to develop a PI? Well, nobody's looked at that very well. I found in the literature. Okay, and that's my question. Can this result in the development of a PI? We think it's rare. There was a single study where they used frozen semen from a known persistently infected bull. They inseminated 12 susceptible heifers. This resulted in all of them being pregnant. They were inseminated a couple of times to get them all pregnant. All of them became infected. Whoops, I got to back up one. And hit escape. Okay. All of them became infected. One out of the 12 was a PI. Well, now, here it's a little different. Here, this is a persistently infected bull that was in this study. The amount of organisms that were going to be shed was considerably, maybe a thousandfold more times than what you would have with a transiently infected animal. Okay? But they froze it in semen where we had a minimal inseminate dose of semen being placed in that cow. So it would be much less organisms than what would be placed in that cow with natural service. So we know we could develop a PI calf from that thing. What does that mean relative to natural service? I'd have to say the conclusion is if we had a bull out there that was a PI bull, that we could likely create a PI calf if that bull bred the cow with natural service. If it's a transiently infected bull, I don't know. Okay. What about wildlife? What does this implication mean for them relative to the transmission of this virus to the domestic livestock? Well, we know this same family of viruses affects other species, so the implications are really unknown at this point. BVD herd effects. They're quite varied. It depends on your herd status. Have you had no exposure? Are you an endemic herd? Or are you right in the early stages of broad exposure with your herd? Okay. Here's a case history of a herd in Colorado that we've dealt with, and I could have pulled about a half a dozen of these out. He had almost 2,700 cows and heifers there. In November, when they preg checked, they had 2,349 pregnant. From there until the time of calving, they observed 9 abortions. They weren't too concerned about it. But the time they finished calving, they only had 2,162 calves born alive. That's a big difference from the 9, isn't it? Actually, there was 188 cows that failed to calve. Now, they were not looking at them every day. When it came to weaning, they only weaned 2,011 calves. So if we put that in terms of information here, the pregnancy rate was 89%. In the yellow off to the right was the 3-year averages that this herd had had previously, the 3 years previous. 92% was what they generally run. That was pretty close. They were only 89. Pretty subtle. The pregnancy wastage, based on cows exposed, was 7%. Based on the cows that were called just pregnant, it was 8%. But they were typically, they had been under 2% of the cows that were pregnant. The calf losses from birth to weaning, their traditional history said they'd been under 4%, and they experienced 6-7% losses. Okay, if you look at their overall impact, clear through the reproductive cycle, from breeding to pregnancy to weaning, they had roughly an 11% drop in what their expected calves wean compared to what they were normally. Okay. This herd was kind of interesting because they suffered losses throughout all age groups. And this is some of the management things that they put in place. They decided to purchase their replacement animals. And they bought all their animals from a single source, from an operation that was out of state for them. And we're talking over 400 heifers that were bought in. Once those heifers had calved, and they had some of those heifers, there were about 3 to 4 of those heifers that actually died after they purchased them before calving and after calving for no explained reasons. They never followed up on that. And then they took those calves, those heifers with the calves on their side, and they mixed them with all age groups for breeding. And then the information I told you was the subsequent reproductive information. Well, that ought to send a flag up to you that some management strategies should be and should include separation of animals by age groups so we can kind of contain this virus within younger age groups within the herd and do a better job of eliminating them. So common case history on the initial, if you've had initial exposure, Mick, that you may have your pregnancy rate may drop 3-6%. Now, recognize the longer your breeding season is, the less drop you're going to have in pregnancy rate because you've got more opportunities for that female to get pregnant and catch up if you're just using pregnancy rates as your evaluation. I actually like to look at a subset of this, and that is to look at calving distribution and see how much of a drop we have in those cows calving the first 21 to 42 days. Pregnancy losses usually will go up. I think that's the flag I'm looking for as much as anything. Calf losses may be up 3-6%. But if you're at the low end of either pregnancy rate or calf losses, I would dare say that many of the operations that I've dealt with over the years would not think too much about it. They would think it's just year-to-year variation. But when you start adding those losses up, you get quite substantial. Okay, economics. In a work that was done where they looked at a 10-year farm profitability model, looking at the impact of persistent infection, they found in herds that really had PI animals in them, high-risk herds, they found an economic effect of $14 to $24 per year. That's per beef cow exposed. Okay, if you go to that herd that I was telling you about, in terms of their numbers, they would be the first one to tell this researcher that their model is wrong, that they are grossly underestimating the cost of this disease on their particular operation. I was amazed at the figure that the producer came up with in terms of what the impact of this had been in a 2- and 3-year program on his place. Okay. Now, transmission, the PI animal is the main source of transmission. Most commonly, this occurs by the introduction of a PI animal to the herd. Statistically, If you have a prevalence of 2% PIs, your risk of purchasing a PI animal in a group of 20 is 33%. This is a statistical method determining your risk. And that's determined by looking at what's the probability of buying a non-PI animal compared to the probability of buying a PI animal. That's how they come up with that figure of 33%. You buy a group of 400, what's your chances? Okay. This is in an endemic herd. We got one PI incidence here, or a prevalence of less than 1%. Very low, only 5 animals out of 29, 21. PI animals were removed prior to breeding. Bleeding these animals at weaning, the serum neutralization titers determined for blood samples, and we were between 4 to 6 months of age, we had titers greater than 512 that we considered that indicated exposure to viruses from the PI animal, either indirectly or through the other animals, through the transient infections going in. For type 1 BVD, we had a 20.6% seral prevalence, and type 2, we had a 44, almost a 45% prevalence, which shows you from a low PI incidence, you can still have that virus going through the herd at a tremendous rate. Okay, so what's the rationale for BVD control? I think we've built the case that we've got to address the PI animal as being the source of infection. The presence of any PI animal is significant. Okay. What about vaccination? Vaccination plays a critical role in the control, in that reduced reduction, but it does not prevent PIs. It just reduces the risk. And it should be part, because of that lack of having complete protection there, you know, you need to look at herd-level control strategies. Now, what are some control strategies? Well, this slide here certainly doesn't have it all on. It's not supposed to be doing transition, but it's doing it. Can you back that up one? Okay. We're going the wrong way. Okay. You could put your herd control strategies into three things. One, either herd monitoring / surveillance type programs, and we don't care whether you're an unexposed herd that you haven't ever had the problem before. We think you should have some kind of a surveillance plan in mind to prevent the introduction of BVD to your herd. In high-risk herds where you have BVD or a history of it, you need to actively seek testing and culling those PIs from your herd. Vaccination should be part of that strategy. We would encourage you to review the information relative to the individual vaccines on what they have relative to targeting fetal protection. It's my contention there's limited data available. Most vaccines were designed to prevent the acute or the transient infection, and the vaccine was not developed from the standpoint of looking at fetal protection. Okay. Is my herd infected with BVD? Some of your clinical history ought to tell you that there. From a monitoring surveillance standpoint, if you're having suspect newborns, respiratory disease cases, abortions, stuff like that there, consider getting some of them worked up so you know whether you've got it there or not. Time to get to weaning, look at your suspect calves there, some unthrifty calves. But remember, you can't tell whether that's a PI animal or not. Okay. If you have any animals that die and you have a necropsy, if there's something with suggestive lesions for BVD, then that information needs to be kept. Okay. from a standpoint of surveillance. What could we do to detect the BVD presence or absence? On these, on the monitoring place, we could do serology on them, paired serum, been used in the past. Some herds are using sentinel animals. In other words, they have within the herd animals that are not vaccinated, that are running with the rest of them, and they actually use those non-vaccinated animals where they'll get samples from them and see if virus is circulating through the herd. That is one approach. Sometimes they're getting pre-colostral serum samples, another pre-colostral, pre-nursing samples from newborn calves, or they could go with the virus detection from the PI animals. But if we're going to test and cull PI animals, what we're talking about is moving beyond the surveillance standpoint. We're moving towards a biosecurity plan. Now, if your management structure is such that you're adding new additions or you're contemplating expansion, we don't care whether you're a low risk or whether you've had it in the past, it would behoove you on your introduced animals to have a plan in place so that you're not bringing more stuff onto your plates. Yes, it would be nice to test these animals pre-arrival. Bulls, for example, here you got an opportunity so that they are not going to be selling somebody a PI bull. There's a case where it can work. You're buying pregnant animals. If you test the pregnant animal, that pregnant animal may be a non-PI animal. But what about the calf that's inside of her? There's no guarantee there. So in that case, literally, you're looking at a situation where you may have to wait until the calf is born and test the calf and see if the calf is positive and then come back to the cow. The calf is the primary focus on a herd basis. Okay. Herd test strategies, if you've got a large infected herd, stuff like that there, like the herd we showed you, we actually went in and every calf that was born was tested. That was across all age groups. That's what we had to do. And we eliminated a lot of animals from going to the next breeding season. If we had a PI calf, we went back to the dam. And in that particular herd, we never found a dam that was infected at all. It was only the calves. Okay. And we also tested all the bulls and that did not have calves, we tested those. Now, if you have a negative herd, okay, your biosecurity plan should, you might look at different things that you may want to do. And I always put the do nothing down at the bottom, and I think it ought to be self-evident why you put it down at the bottom, because if you do nothing, you do nothing to control your risk for bringing BVD into your herd. Okay, so you move up the ladder a little bit here. If you're a negative herd, what would vaccination do for you? Well, it may have an impact on decreasing your risk for introduction of BVD and reduce your risk even if you do have the exposure, but it's not going to eliminate the production of that PI animal within your herd. When you go to the biosecurity where you're checking these animals before they come into your herd or the calves before they go to breeding, that's when you're doing the most good. Okay. Now, I'm going to point out most herds are low-risk herds. Okay, but in classification of herds as low-risk, many herds do not know what their status is. So they're just lumped immediately into the low-risk herd. And either lack of records or lack of goals in terms of what their production should be may mean that they're actually in another category. Okay. If you've got a low-risk herd, I think you better be monitoring to whether you have that infection or not. Now, look at your production records. See if you're where you should be. Have goals in mind so that you can see whether this is a problem. Test all new herd additions. Okay. Prevent effective contacts. Do you have quarantine plans in place? Use vaccination to target fetal protection. Okay. In working with producers, one of the things I have observed relative to vaccination programs, they have generally been done so the vaccination of the animal is at the convenience of the owner and not necessarily to optimize the efficacy of the vaccine. For example, if you're looking at trying to optimize fetal protection in a vaccine, would you be better off vaccinating at the time you preg check, or would you be better off vaccinating pre-breeding? It should be pretty evident that vaccinating pre-breeding is where you should be doing if you're looking at the goal of fetal protection. I dare say most herds will vaccinate at preg checking or have traditionally been doing that. Okay. If you got a positive herd and you know you got BVD in there, you're moving beyond biosecurity. You're moving to a biocontainment. You're trying to contain that virus so it's going to have minimal or so you can contain it and eliminate it. So your goal is to try to eliminate BVD animals. And this is going to reduce the risk for you. Again, we've got operations that choose to do nothing and they just end up with it continually every year. Now I've got I need to back up one. One more. Yeah. Okay. In herds that are infected with BVD and high-risk herds, use your test and cull strategies. You know, and you may be using other biosecurity issues on certain herds. Large herds that have a separation by age and everything else like that there, you may actually classify your younger animals into a higher risk group and your mature cows because you've done your separation, your test and culling has been so that as you've got animals getting to be 4 years of age, you have very little chance of PIs. You may have a high-risk and low-risk herd right within your operation, cattle groups. So you may look at a very broad program here. This is just a flow sheet here. We got about 3 minutes here. Okay. This is the point here. If you have positive calves, you should remove that positive calf and dam from the herd pre-breeding. And it says right here to sell that positive calf for slaughter. That calf's on the cow. How many times are you going to be able to sell that calf for slaughter right then? You certainly don't want that calf to be going with your herd here. If the cow is positive, you're going to sell the cow to slaughter. But if she's negative and the calf is positive, I dare say many of you are going to be tempted to keep that cow and calf around until weaning. If you can handle them separately, okay. But the point that you're doing, if you keep it around, you're focused on that $500 value of that calf at the end of the year. You're going to try to sell that to a feedlot. Data suggests if you've got a group of feedlot animals with one PI in, you increase the number of sicks and deaths in that fed group. Many feedlot people don't want those animals. Okay? I want you to contrast this. The $500 value of what you perceive that animal is going to be compared to the many dollar losses that that animal really represents. You keep it around the herd, shedding a lot of virus is going to be a lot more dollars than if you eliminate that animal right then. So I would advocate in many situations, you're better off actually if you got a PI calf like that there. You know, if you can't get it to slaughter, Don't take it to the sale barn and sell it to somebody else. You're just perpetuating the problem. Okay. What about vaccinations and PI animals? This is the one thing here. This is a brief summary of what's in there for fetal protection. In general, I would have to say modified live vaccines have shown greater fetal protections than inactivated vaccines. Second point, if the challenge BVD virus is genetically similar to the strain that's in the vaccine, we will have better fetal protection than if the challenge virus is one of the different strains. Remember, we have many different strains that are out there. So the vaccine strain may not be the one that you're being exposed to. So we do get a little more fetal protection if we have in the vaccine similar strains to what they're being exposed to. The other point is, if we have very low dose exposure to that virus, we will have better fetal protection than if we have high virus exposure. This should again come back and reemphasize how important that PI animal is in the herd, because they're shedding large numbers, and large numbers of virus can overwhelm the protective level that is in the vaccine, even if it is the same strain. So those things should come back to you and serve as a point of thought. Okay. The take-home message is all herds should have a monitoring or surveillance plan. You should have a plan in place for monitoring new herd additions, bulls as well as females. In high-risk herds, you need to put a plan together to eliminate PIs. And that's all I've got to say, and we'll open it up for questions right now. Thank you.